If you think that any manufacturer of Frankenfish is going to voluntarily put that on the label of that fish, you're not thinking straight.
Senator Murkowski continues the push for supermarket labeling of GE salmon. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, controversy over a review of game harvest regs on national wildlife refuges and preserves.
What the Department of Interior did in the last 8 years through policy is directly contrary to what that federal legislation says.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Federal regulators have already approved genetically engineered salmon for human consumption. One reason it's not for sale in the U.S. is because of a few short paragraphs that have hitched a ride on a congressional spending bill. It says GE salmon can't be sold until the FDA publishes final labeling guidelines, and the agency hasn't done that. Senator Lisa Murkowski has again inserted a rider in the agriculture spending bill, which would continue the restriction for a year. The bill cleared the Appropriations Committee this week. Murkowski insists the labeling has to be mandatory.
Instead, right now, labeling is voluntary. And if you think that any manufacturer of Frankenfish is going to voluntarily put that on the label of that fish, you're not thinking straight.
A company called Aqua Bounty is growing an engineered salmon in Panama from eggs that are fertilized with genetically altered milt in Canada. The product is designed as a fast grower for fish farming. In 2015, the FDA ruled the fish is safe for human consumption. Murkowski's rider also says the acceptable market name for the Aqua Bounty fish has to include the terms genetically engineered or GE. Murkowski has also filed a separate GE salmon labeling bill.
If families are going to serve this, then I think they deserve to know that what you're eating is not the wild-caught salmon.
Mandatory labeling for genetically modified organisms is controversial in Congress. Many farm state lawmakers say there's no scientific basis to label GMO foods differently, and they maintain it will erode public confidence in GMO crops. Murkowski says a genetically engineered fish is different. The Trump administration has directed the National Park Service in Alaska and the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge to reconsider bans on certain state-allowed game harvest techniques. July 14th memos from Acting Assistant Secretary for Fish and Wildlife and Parks, Virginia Johnson, to the directors of the two Alaska entities tell them to initiate a new rulemaking process in light of effects on sport and commercial hunting and trapping. In an email response to a request for comment, Interior Department Press Secretary Heather Swift says there is no predetermined outcome of the reviews and that, quote, the department is committed to working with the people of Alaska on how to best manage their wildlife and habitat. The reviews mean second looks at regulations banning a range of state-allowed harvest practices, including taking black bears with artificial light at den sites, killing of brown and black bears over bait, use of dogs to hunt black bears, harvest of wolves and coyotes during denning season, and killing swimming caribou or taking them from a motorboat while under power. National Park Service Alaska Region spokesman John Quinley says the agency will have to do over the rulemaking process used for development of the current regulations.
To go back out to the public, I can't speculate on what any new proposed rule might include, but public input is going to be a key part of the process.
Quinley says the majority of comments received during the first go-around were in favor of the regulations banning the harvest practices.
But rulemaking is not a voting contest.
Targeting predators and managing them to scarcity is not consistent with the purposes of the refuge and preserve lands.
Pat Lavin is the Alaska representative for the group Defenders of Wildlife.
It's troubling to to see that we're reopening this whole issue so shortly after the regulations were completed on this front. But we'll participate again, and I'm sure the public will as well, and I hope that the new administration will be open to outcomes that are not inconsistent with their own statutory obligations and with what the public wants.
Defenders of Wildlife is one of several environmental groups fighting a state of Alaska filed suit aimed at turning back the regulations. The state constitution calls for managing fish and game for sustained yield, while the Park Service mission is to provide for natural diversity. Conflicting mandates central to a broader debate over states' rights. Executive Director of the Alaska Outdoor Council, Rod Arnold, refers to guarantees included in the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act that created many of Alaska's federal preserves and refuges.
To make sure that the state of Alaska would remain the authority on management of fish and game on federal lands. And what the Department of Interior did in the last 8 years through policy is, you know, directly contrary to what that federal legislation says.
Arno says hunting, trapping is common on federal lands in Alaska, especially road accessible portions of the 70 million acres set aside in national preserves. Earlier this year, Congress repealed harvest technique bans in other U.S. fish and wildlife refuges in Alaska using the Congressional Review Act. But the Park Service and Kenai Refuge rules fall outside the action timeframe allowed under that law. Juneau gets thousands of cruise ship visitors a day, more than any other port in Alaska. And while those visitors and the cruise ships that ferry them around the state bring an influx of cash into coastal communities, they bring something else, too, pollution. Monitoring cruise ships can be expensive for state agencies. Most of them have experienced deep cuts in recent years. But as Rasha McChesney from Alaska's Energy Desk explains, this one is on someone else's dime.
Over 1 million cruise ship visitors are projected to land in Juneau this year, more than any other port in the state. And the summer cruising season is a big boost for coastal retailers. But it also brings all of the noisy traffic, haze, and water quality issues of big cities to small towns in Alaska. On a rainy weekday, Ed White walks with me down a busy sidewalk in Juneau. We're dodging tourists who stop to photograph ravens against a panoramic, foggy mountain backdrop or dip into one of dozens of retailers downtown.
It's like urban science.
It is sometimes. We know often we try to get out earlier in the morning when traffic's not as bad, and we can also start closer up on the hill there near where some of the stairways and apartments are and do our air readings there.
White works for the state's cruise ship monitoring program, and money collected from the cruise ship passengers is the reason he can do his job. Each passenger forks over a small fee to the state, and it pays for things like air and water quality monitoring. It's just a few dollars a ticket, but that money adds up. The state has collected more than $5 million this year. White's cruise ship monitoring team is one of the only bright spots in the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, or DEC's, budget.
Looking at the bigger long-term picture, that's probably, you know, the most reliable funding source that we have, that those fees that fund that program.
That's Ruth Kostick. She's DEC's budget manager. Alaska has been struggling with a multi-billion-dollar budget deficit brought on by low oil prices. And most departments have taken big budget hits as the state tries to bring its spending down and its revenue up. As lawmakers decide how to divvy up the state's general fund money, state departments have seen deeper and deeper cuts. Over the last 4 years, DEC has seen a drop of more than one-third of the unrestricted money it usually gets from the general fund. And those cuts mean state monitors aren't able to keep an eye on a lot of things. Find bedbugs in your hotel room? Too bad. The state doesn't do hotel sanitation inspections anymore. Rusty shears at your local salon? Well, they don't inspect barbers or hairdressers either. Even some small drinking water systems don't get inspected anymore. Kostick says DEC has lost 60 positions in the last few years. But for now, the cruise ship monitoring program is shielded from those cuts as Alaska's cruising industry is booming. Back in downtown Juneau, Ed White and I head down to the dock. Someone called his office to complain that the MV Nordam was belching smoke into the air as it motored into Juneau. Now tied up, the Nordam towers over downtown. It has 11 decks and is about the same height as the tallest building in town.
That there was a smoke while they were maneuvering. They were turning around to come into the dock. So that tends to be a time where ships are using their engines more.
White's office gets these calls pretty regularly. He says they average about one a week during the cruising season.
You know, a lot of people here in Juneau grew up with ships. They've been here for years. So people know what ships generally look like when they're maneuvering, when they're doing things. And often we get calls when something's out of the ordinary.
Clean air, clean water, responsible ships. It's important for a lot of Alaskans. The state was the first to require a Coast Guard licensed marine engineer to ride along with the cruise ships. They're independent observers, put there by a 2006 voter referendum that created the Ocean Ranger program. It's paid for by a $4 fee levied against passengers. In 2016, rangers reported more than 170 separate incidents, alleging oil pollution, wastewater, and air pollution violations, and potential safety hazards. And the ships will call in too, often self-reporting a problem as they're fixing it. And for now, that monitoring will continue, shielded from the state's shredded budget by out-of-state visitors. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, when two sides collide at a bowling alley.
I've never seen so many happy homeless people next to so many happy cops at the same time.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
A Veterans Town Hall featuring Dr. Timothy Ballard will take place on July 25th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Bernard Memorial Sports Center in Wasilla. The event is open to all. The VA welcomes frank and open discussions of veterans' concerns in all program areas. Time will be made available for individuals to address their concerns in one-on-one sessions. For more information, email samuel.hudson@va.gov. This message sponsored by the VA.
Hot, dry weather over the northern interior is keeping wildfire season alive longer than normal. Alaska Fire Service spokesman Sam Harrell says the activity continues at a time when the region usually shifts to rainier conditions.
It is wetter on the north slope. It's just not making it south of the Brooks Range.
There have been rain showers, but Harrell says they haven't hit all areas, allowing fires burning for weeks to persist and new lightning-caused starts.
Out west in the Galena Zone, the Tanana Zone across the middle part of the northern interior around Bettles, and then of course over northeast of Fort Yukon, those fires are still going.
There are about 50 wildfires listed as active right now, including a new start in the White Mountains National Recreation Area north of Fairbanks yesterday. The new blaze and most others are in limited management areas and being allowed to burn. Harrell says a few are getting attention from firefighters who are focused on protecting cabins and native land allotments. Harrell says state and federal agencies are retaining enough people and aircraft to work Alaska fires as the season winds down and demand for resources heightens in the lower 48. About 170 Alaska firefighters, as well as an air retardant tanker and two water scooping planes, have been sent south. Scientists are using an underwater camera to keep close tabs on Atka mackerel to make sure there's enough for endangered sea lions and commercial fisheries. KUCB's Barrett Wilbur has more.
Counting Atka mackerel became really important, Suzanne McDermott says, when Steller sea lions were declared endangered in 1997.
We learned that Atka mackerel are their main food item. So that's when we really started looking at that fish with relationship to Steller sea lion.
As a National Marine Fisheries Service biologist, McDermott knows the mammals face competition for their food from commercial fishermen. Last year, Alaska fishermen caught and kept 55,000 metric tons of Atka mackerel and discarded another 532 tons as bycatch. This summer, McDermott and her colleague David Bryan traversed the Aleutian chain to answer a big question. Are there enough fish to support both endangered Steller sea lions and commercial fishermen?
The interest for us is to understand how much ECA macro is available to sea lions and how much ECA macro is available to the fishery to make sure that sea lions get enough prey, especially in areas where they're declining.
But counting the fish is difficult. Traditionally, fish abundance is measured by trawl net, but McDermott says trawl nets are useless in the near shore waters of sea lion rookeries. So the scientists built a camera. It hangs underwater, close to the seafloor, and live streams mackerel footage through armored cables up to their research vessel. Unlike a trawl net, it can navigate around rocks, crags, and coral. Plus, the camera's stereoscopic side-by-side lenses mean that they can measure the length of each fish without catching it. Brian says that's invaluable.
With the length, we can estimate their age. We can also estimate their weight, and that's helpful because we can then estimate biomass, which then kind of ties back into food sources for sea lions.
McDermott has been studying Atkin mackerel for 20 years, but says the camera gives her a new perspective.
You start to relate to fish more as beings with a brain, whereas when they come up in a trawl, all you see is that particular fish in a net. You don't understand where it lived and how it moved.
The camera gives them new understanding into fish behavior. For example, McDermott thinks sea lions rely on mackerel because the fish guard their eggs, making them a dependable meal. These insights help the scientists build a more complete understanding of a resource that's key to both sea lions and fishermen. In Unalaska, I'm Barrett Wilbur.
The Alaska Department of Natural Resources is beginning to work through tideland lease applications for the mariculture industry. Current and potential new farmers are applying to use state tidelands to grow Pacific oysters and geoducks. Those are all typical requests, but what's different this year is the acreage farmers are requesting and increasing interest in kelp farming. KBBI's Aaron Bolton has the story.
The number of applications for mariculture tideland leases this year are the highest DNR leasing unit manager Christy Collis can remember.
Yes, this was a large year. We actually got 18 applications, 15 of those being new.
The roughly 1,000 acres requested are staggering compared to last year's three applications for about 18 acres. Most of the spike can be attributed to an increasing interest in kelp farming. Just under half the applications are for kelp permits, but they make up about two-thirds of the requested acreage. The mariculture industry can be difficult to break into, with long turnarounds for profits. Geoduck farmers just starting out can wait up to 10 years before money starts rolling in, and Pacific oysters typically take about half that time. A 2015 Alaska Division of Economic Development study shows that larger mariculture operations generally make profits faster due to efficiency. Farms that also diversify their harvest are more likely to see profits sooner rather than later. Director Brittany Choney Haywood began overseeing the division as the study concluded.
If we were to go back and redo the study, that you would find incorporating that kelp would, you know, increase the success of those farms because it allows a cash flow much sooner.
Public notices have begun to go out for some of this year's tideland applications. Leasing manager Collis hopes to wrap up the public process this fall, but doesn't know how long it will take with a larger load. Kodiak-based commercial fisherman Nicholas Mangini is among this year's applicants. His business, Kodiak Island Sustainable Seaweed, harvested about 15,000 pounds of ribbon and sugar kelp on 1 acre this spring. He hopes to expand his operation to 18 acres. Mangini sold to one buyer last year. He plans to sell to that buyer again, but he also hopes to develop new kelp products and directly market them. Mangini adds that those jumping into the evolving kelp industry should know it's not easy.
I think there's a lot of people excited about it, but I think the application process is a lot more rigorous than people are realizing, and it's not just as easy as throwing some lines in the water and growing some kelp. There's quite a bit to it. I mean, I did a lot of research and read a lot of manuals and other people's issues for a year before I even got involved.
If Mangini's expansion is approved, he plans to harvest his first large batch in May of 2018. Reporting in Homer, I'm Aaron Bolton.
A new park in Anchorage has received $750,000. The federal grant is part of a nationwide program to enhance parks and recreation facilities in underserved communities. Muldoon Town Square Park is being developed on the site of a former nursery. Anchorage Park Superintendent Josh Durand says construction of the park has been underway since last fall.
We've been working on phase one, which is parking lot, plaza, picnic shelter, playgrounds, community, a farmer's market space for community events.
Durand says they plan to use the grant to connect different areas of the park and begin the second phase of development. Plans for phase two include a community garden, a bike pump track, and an orchard and rock climbing boulder. The grant for the park was awarded by the U.S. Department of Interior and requires a 50% match from the municipality.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, bowling for bonding. On Saturday, homeless Juneau residents and local police competed on equal terms at a downtown bowling alley to draw donations for the city's Glory Hole homeless shelter. KTOO's Quentin Chandler reports that the same people who use the shelter's services helped them raise a nice chunk of change.
Tonight it's the street versus the beat. All but one of the seven people bowling against the police are homeless or in some kind of unstable housing. Wayne Fu Smallwood is 67 and lives in a cabin in the woods.
I just got wood stove and candles, but I'm happy.
Smallwood says he doesn't have bad interactions with police, but he says a lot of people living on the street try to avoid cops.
Because when you're on the street, you're on a sidewalk, you want to stay away from the cops, and if they come around, then you have to move on.
He's referring to a sore subject in Juneau. Often property owners call police to stop homeless people from sleeping in downtown Juneau doorways. Smallwood thinks it's good for the two teams to play each other.
I think it could probably open some doors and let people that are like on the street, whatever, come to the cops with their problems instead of trying to deal with it themselves.
Right now, both teams are celebrating strikes and laughing at occasional gutter balls. Officer King Colon says tonight, everyone has the same goal.
Just to have fun, let our hair out, have fun, and just be individuals. So it's a lot of fun and more of a personal side, you know, human side.
Colon walks the downtown beat and comes face-to-face with Juneau's homeless every day.
I know a lot of stories that they are intimate with me about and have a better understanding with them. However, tonight, you know, we're all equal. Tonight feels like we're all equal. We're just having fun and kick back, relax. That's pretty much how I feel, and I think everyone else feels the same way.
Rebecca Service is the woman who organized the event. She says her goal is to bring Juneau's homeless and police closer.
Instead of separating people into categories and just kind of meeting on the same lane, you know?
Service moved to Juneau 2 months ago from San Francisco, and right now she sleeps in her van. She was going to do this same event before she left San Francisco. She was inspired when she saw several cops wearing gray bowling shirts. She asked if they bowled.
Hey, are you guys in a bowling league? And they're like, what do you mean? Like, we're wearing all bowling shirts, right? And they got grumpy and walked off. But then the next cop I saw, I'm like, hey, do you bowl? And he's like, I bowl 220. What do you bowl? I'm off at bowling. But would you bowl me if I bowled, you know, if I set it up? And he said, if you do it, I'll show up to it.
Eventually, more cops signed on to the idea, but finding space to play was impossible in the big city. Now that she's living in Juneau, that isn't a problem.
Anywhere you go, you should leave it better than you found it. And I came here and I kind of put that idea out there and I got a good response. It's an amazing community here that's very supportive of each other.
The game is over and the winner is...
Technically, the streets won. Our average is a little bit higher than the police officers. So I think it was really great. I've never seen so many happy homeless people next to so many happy cops at the same time.
Officer Colon seconds that. He says his bowling game was below marginal, but you can't tell from his face.
Smiling and playing is good therapy. That's pretty much what I can come up with. It's great therapy.
And they made pretty good money, too. Service says the event raised about $3,000 from food sales, a silent auction, and donations. All of the gifts will go to the Glory Hole Shelter. In Juneau, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Jim Teal, a financial planner living in Anchorage. When he first moved to Alaska, he got a job doing fishery surveys along the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. His story is part of Midnight Oil, a new podcast from Alaska's Energy Desk.
Our goal in traveling the entire pipeline corridor was to survey all of these small streams to find out there were fish in them. And if there were fish in them, and if there was a problem with the pet passage, we could alert the company and say, okay, you guys need to replace this culvert. And they were in a hurry to get the pipeline done. One of the issues was we were these wet behind the ear Chichaco college kids, and we were rubbing elbows with a bunch of grizzled old construction guys, you know, these guys that would lay under the pipe all day and weld. I had a lot of respect for those guys. I mean, they were doing an amazing job at an amazing pace. You know, they looked at us and said, oh, these guys are just trying to cause us trouble. And every time they find fish in this stupid little creek that's 2 feet wide, you know, we got to go dig up the road and put a new culvert in. And so they were not happy about that. They liked to prank us. We had a truck that was assigned to us. Sometimes you come out in the morning, and one of the favorite things they'd do is they'd let the air out of one of the tires in the front. Another favorite was they'd smear honey or mustard or something on the door handles. You know, so you go out and grab the door handle first thing in the morning and you stick to it. It's all covered with flies and mosquitoes. My partner and I came out one morning and said, man, I know we rolled the windows up in that truck. I know we didn't leave the windows open because it was supposed to rain, and I know we shut them. So I walked over to the truck, and I don't know who jumped further, me or the little black bear that was sitting in the front seat. Someone had taken and thrown a ham sandwich and a bag of grapes into the front seat of the truck and opened the windows wide. And in the middle of the night, this little black bear crawled up in there, and he was just happy as a clam sitting there munching down on the grapes. And I actually thought it was pretty funny after you sat down and thought about it for a little bit. You know, it's very clever. But I'll tell you, after that, we locked the doors of the truck every night.
Jim Teal lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Quentin Chandler and Henry Leisha. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Barrett Wilbur in Unalaska, Aaron Bolton in Homer, and Henry Leisha in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.